You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
The Podcast Network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves. And Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
Hey, this is Rod Adams, and although I put out a couple other shows already this week, it's time for one more. Several days ago, I talked to Charles Barton and Robert Hargraves about a variety of topics, including the Thorium Energy Alliance Conference to be held in Washington, October 19th and 20th of 2009. Soon after I talked with them, I got in touch with John Kutch, who was one of the key organizers for the conference, and had a chat with him. He had a little bit different view and some more information about the conference, so I figured it was time to share that with you as well. The conference, again, is October 19th and 20th in Washington, and it's the first meeting of the Thorium Energy Alliance, a group that is aimed at sharing what they know and working to build thorium as a long-term energy alternative that produces no greenhouse gases and apparently produces less waste long-term than the use of uranium. So I'll let John explain that to you and talk to you a little bit more about the Thorium Energy Alliance Conference. I'm told by your friends on the Thorium Energy Forum that you are the organizer of the Thorium Energy Alliance Conference.
I am indeed. And, you know, we got a lot of folks that are helping put it together, but I'm the fellow that pulled the trigger on trying to get an advocacy group together, and then shortly after that, I figured we were always sort of planning on having a conference, and a few things came up where I thought, well, you know, better sooner than later, and some of the legislation sponsored by the fine politicians out there, as well as an article being written for Wired Magazine, I thought there might be a good confluence of press and political support to try and, you know, go out there and be advocates and get heard.
Well, certainly a topic of interest to a lot of people. I mean, nuclear in general is getting some interesting press these days in the business press. I think in the same week I saw an article in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times of London.
Yep. Yeah, they were for the conference. C-SPAN has said that there's a better than even chance that they'd be willing to cover the conference. Congressman Sisak is going to send along his energy policy advisor along with some video of Sisak supporting the cause, and I think we're also going to have you know, coverage by Science News and New York Times, the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune. You know, we're just been hitting these guys, and have to do a little bit of education, a little bit of footwork, but once they look it up and see it's a legit topic and not just some pie-in-the-sky, you know, propeller heads out there proposing something, you know, that's the trouble about thorium, is that it does so much and is sort of revolutionary to a lot of people that they think it's, you know, they think it's like science fiction. They can't believe that the technology exists to do the things that we want to do with thorium.
Hmm. Well, from my point of view, and most people, if they really understood what fission does, it would find it to be completely science fiction. I mean, I have on my desk a little pellet, and I like to hold it up to people and say, you know, With current technology, this is about 147 barrels of oil. But if we fissioned it completely, it'd be 1,470 barrels of oil. Pretty amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
The energy density in heavy metals is just completely fascinating to me.
You know, and I think that, you know, I drive a Saturn, and I, what's so unbelievable about that is that I drive a Saturn, and I'm, you know, every time I fill up, I'm like, you know, I can't believe I get almost 40 miles to the gallon with this old 15-year-old car, and yet it's still probably not much more than, you know, 8, 9, maybe 10% efficient. And then to think, you know, this car could run on a pea-sized piece of thorium, you know, theoretically for years and years and years. It's the energy density, like you said, is mind-blowing.
I did an article one time where I made a computation, and you can still find it online. It says 750 million miles per gallon. And
that's funny.
If you do all the conversions, and of course, a gallon is a unit of volume, so it's significantly more mass in a gallon of uranium or thorium than in a gallon of gasoline. But if you do all the conversions, even with a 20-mile-per-gallon automobile, you get 750 million miles per gallon.
Yep.
Of course, it's hard to put a gallon of fissile material in an automobile, but we can certainly do it.
The trouble we've been having in terms of, you know, right now we're almost exactly 4 weeks away from the conference, and so I've sort of set the begging for attendees on autopilot, and now what I'm doing is I'm begging for media coverage and trying to get us, you know, the whole point of being an advocate is to, you know, get the word out there and show that it's a real cause. And it's, you know, it's hard for even science writers to wrap their heads around stuff like that. You know, to explain to even a science writer that, you know, let's say uranium in a light water reactor, you're using up maybe what, you know, 1, 2, 3, maybe the French are using up to maybe 30% of the uranium, and they're powering whole cities with it. And yet thorium, you know, would be anywhere from 99 to, you know, anywhere from 10 to 99 times more efficient. And the numbers, just even for a science writer, they glaze over. So it's been a challenge trying to get the media to think of this as anything, you know, as anything that they can wrap their heads around.
What kind of attendance do you think you're going to be able to get to the conference?
Excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold here. For the paid attendance, it's looking like we'll have about 50 people, and then we're going to have students and teachers, so that's another handful, somewhere between 10 and 20 people. We're still a month out, so I'm hoping for a little last-minute surge there. And then for confirmed press and representatives of congressmen and senators, that'd be about another 10 people. So, you know, we'll be under 100. We'll probably be somewhere in the 75-person range. But that's pretty good for a conference. That's the first, you know, inaugural thorium energy conference in the United States. And, you know, planned over only about 4.5 months of time. So I think we did pretty good about, you know, asking people in this tough economy to drop what they're doing and come out to Washington to, you know, put their money where their mouth is, fight for what they believe.
Now, I assume from the short organization time that you probably didn't get too many of the international visitors. I know there is some significant international interest in thorium.
Yeah, we just had our third conference call with the group of Europeans. These guys are mostly from Sweden that want to form the European branch of the Thorium Energy Alliance. And, China right now is going to have the Thorium Reactor Design Conference just about a week and a half before our conference in Washington, D.C. on the 19th of October. And China is also having a rare earth metals conference with a special concentration on thorium. And one of the main speakers, Jack Lifton, who's speaking there, will be speaking at our conference. So anybody who wants to get straight from the horse's mouth what China's plans are for thorium, Jack will be bringing it straight back from Mongolia. And wow. He'll be telling us what China's plans are. As far as we know, China's planning on spending, you know, well over $1 billion in the next year or two just to get the reactor design going.
That's pretty impressive.
This brings up a little bit of a leading thing here. I'll ask a question on your behalf. You know, why are we doing this? And one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately, there's a lot of reasons to do this, but one of the things that's been eating away at me a lot lately is thinking that if China or India are able to add cheap, clean energy to their portfolio of cheap labor and cheap manufacturing, that could very well be the death knell of, United States and European standards of living, manufacturing base, however you want to put it, because we'd never be able to climb that curve again. They would, their balance of advantages would be so far ahead of us that the catch-up game, we'd never, it'd be a lost cause. It'd be a geometric progression on their part with their population and low costs, low impact energy. If they got that trifecta in place, and we were mired in this old fossil fuel economy with a token amount of nuclear generation, it would not bode very well for us. And we'd, our resources, if you look at it, we'd have lagging resources because, some people say, well, we'll just put money to copy the thorium generator. And I said, well, what money? We're already borrowing, trillions and trillions of dollars from these people. And at some point, they'd be so far ahead of us that they'd be willing to write us off as their poor cousins, who they loaned money to, and they just write it off as a bad debt, and they'll go on with their own society, and we'll be in the position of countries that just supply raw materials to first world countries. That's a sort of a drastic scenario, and I certainly hope that it is one of the major motivating factors to try and kickstart America to get this process going, so we're not left.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to be a little wordy there, but
no, that's good because I have grave concerns about what might happen to America if we continue in the direction we're going. However, I've been always impressed by Americans' ability to recognize a competitive challenge, not a competitive threat, but a competitive challenge, and the desire to be the best is something that has always motivated America to say, maybe we need to change direction. I was a little bit too young to have actually seen Sputnik flying around, but I certainly enjoyed the attention to science education and engineering and mathematics that occurred as a result of that, or partially
sure.
as a result of that. I watched the space race. I lived in Florida, so I actually watched some launches when I was a kid, and it was pretty impressive. Again, I think that America does have some significant advantages, but we have to start moving in the right direction. If you're heading in the wrong direction, no matter how fast you go, you're not going to get where you want to go.
Well, I think what we are is, I don't know if we're heading in the wrong direction, but I think we're highly stagnant, and with what we've decided to do.
Well, we put $90 billion in the stimulus package towards, or at least we haven't put it yet, but we assigned $90 billion in a stimulus package to develop wind turbines and solar panels.
Yeah.
Which is the wrong direction.
there's one of the talks at the conference that we're going to have that addresses that very thing. And I'm glad you brought it up. I think anybody who looks at the list of topics that are going to be covered at the conference would be fascinated to see the full versions of these talks. But the one that you bring up there, one of the one of the dirty secrets, let's say, it's not really a dirty secret, but one of the things that they're pushing with windmills and solar is they know darn well, when you talk to some of the folks out there, they know darn well it's not going to provide very much energy. But what they're desperate to do is replace manufacturing jobs, and they know it's basically going to be make work. You know, they're going to employ thousands and thousands of people to stand up windmills and stick solar cells on houses and build what they claim is the new grid and put smart meters. And some of that's great. You know, I'm all for efficiency, just like the vice president says, go after the low-hanging fruit. Why not? But don't let anyone kid you that these green jobs is where it's at, or is what they're aiming at. They don't really care about windmills. They don't care about the solar cells. What they care about is that California lost 500,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 8 years, and that is reflected across the country. And what are they going to do for a relatively uneducated, you know, blue-collar population, you know, that makes up our middle class or used to? How do we restore that? Well, you know, the myth of getting a computer education and all this other stuff, it doesn't bring you anywhere. You know, all that can be done easier and cheaper in India, we now know. So how do we bring these manufacturing jobs back? Well, you know, their great, great hope, you know, the great green hope is that we can put thousands and thousands of people together with these jobs, spinning windmills around and putting up solar cells, and the hope in the process that maybe it pays for itself, maybe we get some efficiencies, maybe even turns a profit and makes us a little bit more independent, you know. But the fact is, that's completely secondary to just trying to generate middle-class jobs for people who would have normally been putting bumpers on Chevys.
Yeah, I'm a little more cynical about the motives behind the capital investments than that. I fully believe that there are capitalists out there who fully understand that windmills and solar panels are not going to generate much energy, which is one of the reasons why they're supportive, because it doesn't impede upon their current energy business.
Right.
But the other thing is that it's going to generate an awful lot of imported windmills and solar panels. I mean, I think the only reason China is investing in wind and solar is to develop the ability to make the technology, not so that they're going to build a whole lot of it of their own. That's just the way I've been reading the tea leaves. I mean, how good would a solar panel be in Beijing when they can't even see the sun most of the time?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the idea of energy storage alone is nearly intractable, you know, unless some sort of miracle battery or energy storage solution comes along. You know, this idea of base generation, you know, how many people in the general public are able to wrap their heads around this idea that we need base generation? I have nothing. We have windmills here in Illinois. And we've got them in Iowa where I have a farm, and they're fine. You know, if somebody, I think what they provide small investors, if you got $2 million and you get 20 of your friends, you can put up 50 windmills. You know, great. It's back to small power generation, you know, and, you know, more distributed generation is what we need probably. And, but, you know, just like you say, the fact is, you know, we need base load generation, and the only thing that's going to do that and keep carbon down and all the rest is thorium, you know. Maybe nuclear too, but I think thorium's the better way to go. Traditional nuclear, uranium, light water. But, you know, once you understand the gravity of the thorium argument, it's greatly outweighs the other nuclear options that we have.
Well, except for the fact that the other nuclear options are proven, operating, and has a huge installed base of suppliers and operators and everything else. So, I mean,
well, Kirk Sorensen and I were having a discussion several months ago, and in terms of, like, you know, light water reactors, yeah, indeed, you know, they have the installed base and they're working and functioning right now, and they have operators. But nobody's designed a new light water reactor in 30 years. And we said, you know, if you're going to make lemonade out of lemons, you know, the lemons are we've lost this, you know, this whole intelligence base of, you know, how to design reactors. You know, there just aren't the guys who had the hands-on R&D design experience. They all retired. They're in nursing homes now. So maybe we get to start over. You know, if we get to clean sheet it and do what the guys back in the 50s wanted to do in the first place, we get to do the molten salt reactor or, you know, something. There's guys out there who want to use thorium, you know, MOX reactors and thorium fast breeders and slow breeders. And I tell people, I don't have a dog in this fight. You know, I don't own, you know, I don't own a thorium mine or anything like that. I just want it to, for a successful American future. It's, I suppose it's self-serving that I want, you know, I want the United States and our allies and stuff to stay on top of things. But, you know, when it comes down to it, we have a chance to start over again and, you know, get away from, you know, light water reactors, which are essentially demilitarized, you know, pieces of war machinery, and go to what should have been the real civilian nuclear operation, which is the, you know, thorium-based energy economy.
Well, there's actually very little congruence between a 1,000-megawatt light water reactor and a military power plant. And matter of fact, there's little military-specific... And at this point, my internet connection dropped out again. About 30 minutes of chatting on Skype on Comcast, and all of a sudden, my connection dropped. They tell me it's not because they're blocking Skype. Anyway, back to the show.
I thought you got bored of what I was blabbing at there.
No, actually, I got all the way to the very end of yours, and as soon as I started to respond, I saw a connection loss, so... what I was starting to say was, although the light water reactors started off as power plants for submarines, there's nothing inherently military about a light water reactor. I mean, the light water reactor was a propulsion plant. It was, and, you know, steam power plants and steam propulsion plants have been around an awful long time. And it was never, although people... like Rickover liked to call it a military application, it was just a power plant. You know, it was designed to produce power.
Oh, believe me, you know, Stephen Chu was being interviewed on NPR last week, and they, you know, the NPR guy seemed so surprised. He said, well, would you have a nuclear reactor in your neighborhood? And Stephen Chu, you know, God bless him, he said, yeah, I'd have one in my neighborhood tomorrow. You want to put one in my neighborhood? He said, that may not be the prettiest thing in the world, but they're perfectly safe. And, you know, they have a better track record. You know, this is one of the things we got to get out there is that, you know, nuclear power, whether it's thorium or light water or, you know, whatever, maybe not graphite pile reactors like the Russians have, but, you know, nuclear power doesn't put mercury in the air and, you know, more radiation has been spilled by coal-fired power plants every year than all the nuclear power plants in history have ever, you know, including any accidents like Chernobyl or anything. You know, that pales in comparison to what we've done by burning coal. And but, you know, it's a death by a thousand cuts. You know, one big accident gets attention, you know, just like airline accidents compared to car accidents. No one's ever going to give up their car. You know, even though they know damn well hundreds of thousands of people over a decade die in car accidents and maybe a couple thousand die in airplane accidents. But what are people more worried about, you know?
Yeah.
And well, you know, how do you fight that tide?
You know, there was a hydroelectric dam in Russia that collapsed earlier this year that killed more people than Chernobyl.
Yeah, for sure.
It killed about 55 people immediately. There was also a natural gas explosion from a well in China in December 2003 that immediately killed 270 people and put 9,000 people in the hospital. Most people never heard of that.
Kirk likes to point out, you know, right around Christmas when that ash sludge pond in Tennessee let loose, and I don't think it killed anybody, but it destroyed lots of houses, and had they gotten the second nuclear reactor online at the plant, I actually went to see it with Kirk. I can't remember the name of the plant now. I don't think it has a very exciting name. I think it's called, like, Tennessee Valley Number 2 or something like that. It's, you know, he makes a very valid point. If that plant had come online back in the mid-80s when it was supposed to, that nuclear or that coal plant down the road probably wouldn't have been running. And, you know, Kirk took us to both. He showed us the remnants of the ash sludge explosion, you know, or slide, whatever you want to call it. And he showed us the non-working cooling tower. He said, well, look at that. You know, what kind of price have we paid? And so that's our challenge as an advocacy group to, you know, turn people's heads and say, look, you know, we have an extraordinarily safe record with light water reactors. Imagine how much safer and more cost-effective a thorium-based reactor.
Yeah, it would be hard for the thorium-based reactor to be any safer than a light water reactors. I mean,
right.
A record of zero deaths in commercial reactors in the U.S. over a 55-year period is pretty hard to beat. I mean, you know, it's like, how do you bat better than 1,000?
Right.
So,
well, yeah, you're preaching to the choir there, brother.
You may very well be able to eventually get the cost down below the established cost of a light water reactor, but I think people don't understand just how cheap a light water reactor is to operate. You know, we're generating power today
at
1.7 cents a kilowatt hour.
Yeah, well, that's companies like Exelon have done a very good job of starting to finally, you know, do what they should have done when they first designed these reactors. And what the French have done is they've started to standardize components. And that was the huge downfall of the American nuclear industry. Every plant was stick-built from scratch, you know, from scratch design practically. I mean, they almost every plant was just a fresh start, you know, clean sheet design, which was crazy. They should have done like the French and found, you know, three or four plant designs and just instituted them. You know, that would have greatly increased safety, you know, and then greatly increased cost effectiveness. I think the thorium plants that are envisioned, what they bring to the table is their compact size, relatively compact size, low profile in terms of not needing giant cooling towers, and the fact that you can use these as more of a distributed power generation, almost what, you know, I personally envision is no matter what form they take, you know, I could envision a thorium power plant being almost accepted first as like a peaker plant. You know, and you can put these things, you know, hundreds of them across the country to shore up our sagging grid.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you may not be aware of, there have been a couple of folks that have done some rather innovative light water reactor designs for that same market. Babcock and Wilcox has a 125 megawatt electric light water reactor that's going to come delivered all in one unit. The whole primary is contained inside the pressure vessel. Steam generators. The primary coolant pumps, everything. There's no piping penetrations outside of that pressure vessel.
Right, Isn't Uranium One out of South Africa developing a very small modular reactor also? And they want to put them on barges and send power barges around Asia.
That may be true. I haven't heard about Uranium One. I know that the Russians have a They're going to put an icebreaker engine on power barges. I think they've got two under construction right now. And then,
right.
I think they call it the KLT-40, I think, is their designation. And they're pretty well-proven machines, although they're going to have some trouble, you know, overcoming some of the many years' worth of negative publicity about their previous reactor designs.
Well, then, you know, you have that, you know, the trouble is that goes back to what we were speaking about before with the, you know, the poor perception and how, you know, the PR aspect of this. You know, we've had, gosh, I believe it's over 100 nuclear reactors, you know, floating out there and submarines and battleships and aircraft carriers. And I don't believe outside of one Russian accident that I know of, and that's, you know, it's the Russians, you know, I think they've all operated without without causing any accidents, or you know, as far as anything that I've ever heard reported.
Well, the U.S.
You know, the idea of a floating nuclear power plant, which is Kirk Sorensen's dream, is to have a nuclear power plant, you know, tethered to the bottom of the sea, so you never run out of cooling fluid. You know, okay. You got that going for you, but boy, it goes back to that perception thing.
Well, I think the U.S. Navy has operated over 230 nuclear plants over the years. We have probably about 85 still operating today. We got about 80 submarines and 11 aircraft carriers, so probably closer to 95 power plants still operating in the U.S. Navy, and the Russians and the French and the Chinese and the British have all operated ships at sea. So it's a well-proven application. So tell us exactly where the Thorium Energy Alliance Conference is going to be held. And I think the dates again are the 19th and 20th of October.
Yep, 19th and 20th of October 2009 at the Kellogg Conference Center at the Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be in the main auditorium, brand-new facility. It's got a television studio and a broadcast studio incorporated into it and translation booths. And to answer a question earlier, we are going to have a small group of people from Europe have bitten the bullet in these tough economic times, and they're going to be there. Kirk Sorensen will be there, Jack Lifton, Jim Hendricks from the United States Geological Service will be there. We're going to have Robert Hargraves talking about his Aim High approach, and we're going to have Joe Bonamati speaking. We're going to have a speaker from Berkeley, a speaker from the University of Texas. We're going to have Rahid Maghreb talking about the deuterium hybrid reactor design using thorium from the University of Illinois. So we're going to have a really fascinating and geeky group of folks there, and I'm going to be doing a little bit of teaching about how to work with the media, so media training and how to petition your Congress for action, and of course we're going to have a congressional breakfast with staff members from Orrin Hatch, Harry Reid, Joe Sestak, and a few other folks that we've been smiling and dialing even today, just before we were speaking here on the phone. It's going to be a great conference. It's going to be two big full days of action, and I'm sure it's going to be inspiring to everybody to, you know, especially the folks that attend. They'll have put their money where their mouth is, and they'll started to do the most that we possibly can do right now to bring thorium to the forefront of trying to solve some of our energy issues in this country.
So if somebody wants to find out more about the conference or register, where do they go?
The most straightforward way is to go to thoriumenergyalliance.com, and we've made it as easy as we can. The website isn't as sexy as it could possibly be right now, but it's a very functional website. And if you just go to thoriumenergyalliance.com, all one word, no underscores or spaces, if you scroll down past the conference announcement, at the bottom of the page, there's three PayPal buttons. And one PayPal, you just click it, and it'll get you attending the conference. You just enter your name and credit information, and that'll get you a ticket into the conference for full membership, too, to the Thorium Energy Alliance for newsletter and conference proceedings, T-shirts, things like that. And then the other two are corporate sponsorship. You could buy an ad, or if you just want the fabulous T-shirt, you can click the PayPal button for that. And for $25, all of which is going to the Thorium Energy Alliance, you can get a fabulous Ask Me About Thorium T-shirt.
I was going to say, in order to wear that T-shirt, though, you have to go to the Energy from Thorium website and really start studying up. Because people may ask you about thorium.
Yeah, that's the only trouble. Somebody might actually ask you about thorium, and you'll have to study up, study those 50-year-old diagrams, and you'll be able to. Or you could just stay at the Thorium Energy Alliance site. Has a handy 10 bullet points to spit out whenever your approach as to why thorium would make a wonderful energy source.
Well, I hope you all have a good conference. I expect to try to make an appearance, at least part of it. Unfortunately, I have a fairly busy work schedule in August, in October. But I'll try to be there. Because fortunately for me, I don't have to travel anywhere. I drive right by that area every day. So.
Well, that's great. You could let the membership and let your folks know that we're going to try our hardest to stream the entire conference. The services for streaming video, unlimited streaming, are kind of pricey, and we're looking for somebody to help us out with covering the cost of streaming the video. But at the very least, after the conference is over, the conference will be recorded from the time the first gavel hits to the last gavel hit. Over 2 days, we're going to put probably well over 20 hours of video in segments on a brand new website. The ThoriumEnergyAlliance.com website is going to get a big makeover after the conference, and it'll resemble the TED.com conference website that was visually inspiring to me about how they laid out their conference videos. So it'll be really it'll be a great interactive experience for anybody who can't make it. At least they can see what happened there at the conference from start to finish.
Well, that's going to be a great service, and I'm looking forward to it. Good luck to you, John, and again, I hope to see you at the conference.
Okay, I'm going to see you, man, and we're going to take a picture together with our shirts on, and we'll have to have a cocktail at the executive cocktail committee meeting afterwards if you're available.
Yeah. Well, I do know a few things about thorium. As a matter of fact, one of my claims to fame, although I haven't shared this with too many people, Kirk will tell you that the first time he ever heard about thorium was when he read an article I wrote about the light water breeder reactor, which was the last core of the shipping port reactor designed by Radkowski. And it actually proved that you could breed with a thermal spectrum even in an old light water reactor.
Oh, there you go.
So that was when Kirk first learned about thorium, maybe 12 years ago or so. Anyway, you take care, John. We'll talk to you soon.
You too. All right, thanks. Bye. Bye-bye.
If you decide to go to the Thorium Energy Alliance Conference, please let me know. Perhaps we can meet up. And now, here's a word from the patrons of TPN, the podcast network.
The podcast network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose, to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves. And Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.